All right, welcome everybody to another deep dive. Today we're going to be talking about a case that kind of sits right at the intersection of criminal law and the world of journalism.
Well, that's juicy.
Yeah, and it really does involve a real life situation where exposure of undercover narcotics agents ended up in the courts.
Wow, so like actual undercover cops.
Yeah, it's a pretty significant case, and the case itself that we're focusing on is People v. Kumpkin.
People v. Kumpkin. Okay, I'm taking notes.
Yeah, and it's a California Supreme Court decision from 1973, but it still brings up a lot of questions and things that we still see today, you know, kind of bouncing around in the legal world and the world of journalism.
I mean, this is like, it's classic, right? Like, we're talking about like the core of what it means to be liable for something criminally. Like, when you receive stolen property, what does it actually mean to know something is stolen?
Hmm.
Like, in the eyes of the law, like, what does that actually mean? And then you throw in the whole freedom of the press thing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's like, where's the line,
right?
You know, between the public's right to know and what could potentially be criminal activity.
Like, how do those two things, like, how do those two worlds collide?
And yeah, and how the courts really had to, you know, grapple with that and figure out, okay, where do we draw the line?
Fascinating.
So this deep dive is going to be kind of your streamlined guide to understanding this significant legal moment in time. We've gone through the court's opinion itself. We've pulled apart a pretty comprehensive case brief on it, and we're going to try to lay it out for you. So we're going to look at, you know, what actually happened, you know, the story of the case, the journey it took through the courts, why the California Supreme Court, you know, ruled the way it did, and why this case still matters today.
All right, so like, paint me a picture of what happened. Like, give me the facts, the juicy details.
Okay, so our story begins at the California Attorney General's office.
Ooh, sounds official.
Yeah.
Yeah.
With a mail clerk by the name of Jerry Resnick.
Jerry Resnick, got it. Okay.
So this is where the spark kind of ignites this whole thing.
Right. All right, lay it on me.
So Resnick, somehow, we don't know exactly how, comes into possession of a personnel roster from the Attorney General's office. But this is not just any list of names.
Ooh, okay. There's gotta be more to it.
This roster includes identities, it includes addresses, and it includes phone numbers of undercover narcotics agents.
Oh, so this is big. This is like top secret stuff.
Yeah, and one thing to keep in mind right from the start is that this roster was not marked as confidential.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so he's got this roster. It's got all this sensitive info, but it's not like officially labeled as confidential.
Right.
Gotcha. So what happens next? What does Jerry do with this?
So Resnick takes this sensitive roster to the Los Angeles Free Press.
Ooh, the press. Okay.
And approaches a reporter by the name of Gerald Applebaum.
So he's going straight to the media. Bold move.
Yeah.
What happens next?
And essentially asks him, hey, you know, would you be interested in publishing this? And Applebaum understandably raises concerns about, you know, what the potential fallout could be. You know, obviously this is a very, very sensitive list.
Oh, for sure. You don't just casually publish a list of undercover cops.
But he agrees to, you know, take it to his editor, you know, talk to him about it, see, you know, what they want to do. And Resnick later returns and he leaves the roster with Applebaum.
So he gives him the actual list.
He gives him the actual document and he really emphasizes his desire to remain anonymous.
I mean, that's like textbook whistleblower behavior, right? Like, here's this explosive information, but please don't tell anyone it came from me.
So the Free Press, they do indeed go on to publish this roster as part of an article.
Wow, they actually went for it. Okay.
And following that publication, Resnick actually attempts to get the physical document back, but Applebaum refuses, you know, saying, well, we've secured it. We've put it, you know, in a safe place. But eventually the Free Press does return the actual paper copy of the roster to the Attorney General's office.
So they publish the information and then return the original document. Okay.
Yeah. And then there's another layer to this factual situation.
Okay, there's more.
Yeah. Investigators later find fingerprints.
Oh, this is getting interesting.
Belonging to Resnick, Applebaum, and Arthur Kunkin, who was the editor and owner of the Los Angeles Free Press, directly on the roster itself.
So they've got, like, physical evidence linking all three of them to the document.
Yeah.
Okay, so this sets the stage for a illegal battle, right?
Right. So Applebaum Kunkin and the Los Angeles Free Press are all charged with receiving stolen property.
Receiving stolen property, okay.
Under California Penal Code Section 496. And at the trial court level, you know, there's kind of a mixed outcome. So the Free Press and Kunkin, they're actually acquitted on a separate count that was related to a different document.
So one charge down.
Yeah. And a related charge against Applebaum resulted in a hung jury and was eventually dismissed.
Okay. So mixed bag so far.
But the jury finds all three, Applebaum, Kunkin, and the Free Press, guilty on one count of receiving stolen property.
So they get them on one count.
Specifically concerning that undercover agent's roster.
Right. And this is what leads to the appeal.
Right. And that's what takes this to the California Supreme Court.
California Supreme Court. Big leagues now.
Yeah. So the big question that the justices had to grapple with was there substantial evidence presented during the trial to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that these defendants, you know, knew that the roster was stolen property at the moment they received it?
Okay, so that's the legal crux of the matter. Like, did they know it was stolen when they got it? That's a tough one to prove.
It is. So to really understand the nuances of what the court had to decide, we need to break down the elements of this crime. Like, what actually is receiving stolen property?
All right, let's break it down, yeah.
So California Penal Code Section 496 lays out three key components.
Okay, three components.
That the prosecution had to prove. So first, they had to prove that the defendants received, concealed, or withheld the property in question.
Okay, so that's the first part, possession, essentially.
Right. And second, that this property was obtained through theft or extortion.
Right, so the property had to be illegally obtained in the first place.
Right. And then third, and this is the linchpin of the Kunkin case, that the defendants knew that the property had been obtained in this manner, that they knew it was stolen.
Okay, so that's the tricky part, the knowledge element. They have to prove that the defendants knew it was stolen when they got it.
Right. And that's really the whole, you know, drama of this case. Like, that's where everything kind of hinges.
I can see why this went all the way to the Supreme Court. Yeah. This is a very subtle distinction they're making.
It is. So let's get into why the California Supreme Court ultimately decided to overturn those convictions. And a really big part of their analysis was the uncontradicted testimony given by Jerry Resnick himself.
Okay, so Resnick, the guy who originally took the roster, what did he say?
So he testified under oath that he never informed Applebaum or Kunkin that he was no longer employed by the Attorney General's office.
Interesting. So they might have thought he was still working there, just like sharing information unofficially.
Right. Which obviously, if they believe that he's still working there, you know, even if he's not supposed to be doing what he's doing, you know, it really weakens the argument that they knew that it was stolen.
Right. It makes their knowledge of the theft a lot harder to prove.
Right. And Resnick also maintained throughout the proceedings that he insisted that the roster be returned to the authorities after its publication.
Okay, so he wanted it back. That's important.
Yeah, the court really placed a lot of weight on that.
It makes sense. It suggests he didn't intend to permanently deprive the Attorney General of the roster, which is a key part of the definition of theft.
Exactly, but the prosecution, you know, they weren't just going to give up. They presented what they thought was compelling circumstantial evidence.
Okay, what did they have?
So they pointed to the sensitive nature of the information. You know, obviously this was a list of undercover agents. You know, their safety could be compromised. You know, their effectiveness in doing their job could be compromised. And they also pointed to Resnick's desire to remain anonymous, saying that suggests, you know, that he knew what he was doing was wrong.
Sure, it looks suspicious, right? Like, why be anonymous if you're not doing anything wrong?
Right, and they argued that Applebaum and Kunkin, you know, as experienced journalists, you know, they must have known that publishing such a list could lead to serious trouble.
Okay, so on the surface, it definitely looks bad, but was it enough to prove they knew the roster was stolen in the legal sense?
Well, that's the really key point here. You know, while a reasonable person, you know, might have strong suspicions given the circumstances, the court really had to, you know, apply that legal standard of proving knowledge of theft.
So they couldn't just go on suspicion or a gut feeling.
Right, right. And they reasoned that the sensitive nature of the information, while, you know, obviously raising ethical considerations about publishing it, that it didn't automatically mean that they knew that it was stolen property.
Just because something is sensitive doesn't make it stolen.
Right, right. And similarly, you know, Resnick's desire for anonymity could have stemmed from a variety of reasons. You know, he may have just feared repercussions at his job or, you know, something else entirely, but it doesn't necessarily mean that he stole it.
And the journalist anticipating potential trouble doesn't automatically mean they knew it was stolen either.
Exactly. And that brings us to a really important distinction that the court drew, and that's the legal difference between theft by larceny and the unauthorized disclosure of information.
Okay, so theft versus just sharing information without permission. That's a crucial difference.
It is. So theft by larceny, which is, you know, the kind of theft we're talking about here, requires the intent to permanently deprive the owner of their property. And the California Supreme Court really emphasized that even if Resnick, you know, acted without authorization and taking the roster, his insistence on its return after publication really negated that intent to permanently deprive.
So he may have taken it without permission, but he wanted it back. That changes things legally.
Right. And the court really drew a bright line there between just unauthorized use of information and actual theft by larceny.
So even though the publication caused harm, they couldn't prove that the journalist knew the roster was stolen in that very specific legal sense.
Right. And that brings us to, you know, the substantial evidence standard.
Ah, yes, the classic legal standard.
Which we see a lot in appellate decisions. So can you break that down for us? Like, what does that actually mean?
Sure. The substantial evidence standard is all about whether a reasonable jury could have reached the verdict they did based on the evidence presented at trial. The appellate court isn't retrying the case. They're just looking at the evidence and saying, could a reasonable jury have found the defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt based on this evidence?
So in Kunkin, the court is basically saying that even though the jury did find them guilty, they didn't think a reasonable jury could have reached that verdict based on the evidence presented about whether the defendants knew the roster was stolen.
Exactly. They thought the evidence about the knowledge element was too weak to support a guilty verdict. It might have been suspicious, but suspicion isn't enough for a criminal conviction.
So they overturned the convictions.
Right. And you know, this case didn't just happen in a vacuum. It had broader implications, too.
Yeah, like what?
Well, for one thing, the California legislature responded to the Kunkin case by enacting Penal Code Section 146E. This new law specifically criminalized the malicious disclosure of confidential information about law enforcement officers.
So they saw a gap in the law that Kunkin exposed, and they decided to fix it.
Right. But Kunkin also sparked a wider debate about the limits of press freedom and the potential for journalistic liability when publishing leaked documents.
That's a debate that continues to this day.
Absolutely. And it's a tough one. Where's the line between the public's right to know and the potential harm of disclosing sensitive information?
Yeah. And the court itself, in its opinion, really highlighted the tension in this case. They called the Free Press's publication of the roster gross and callous irresponsibility.
Strong words.
Yeah. But at the same time, they said there wasn't enough evidence to prove the defendants knew it was stolen, so they overturned the convictions.
So they condemned the action but said it wasn't technically a crime.
Exactly.
A complex situation for sure.
So what's the key takeaway from People v. Kunkin? What should our listeners really remember about this case?
The big takeaway is that you can't convict someone of receiving stolen property without proving beyond a reasonable doubt that they knew it was stolen. Suspicion isn't enough. Irresponsibility isn't enough. You have to have solid evidence that they knew it was stolen when they received it.
And it really highlights that tension between freedom of the press and the limits of the law.
Right. The press has a right to inform the public, but there are limits. And those limits have to be proven in court.
It's been a fascinating deep dive into People v. Kunkin. This case really makes you think about the meaning of intent, knowledge, and the challenges of balancing a free press with the rule of law.
It really does. And it leaves us with a question for our listeners to ponder. What if that roster had been clearly marked as classified or confidential? Would that have changed the court's decision? Would that have been enough evidence to prove the defendants knew it was stolen?
That's a great question to consider. And it shows how even a small detail can make a big difference in a legal case.
Absolutely. It highlights the nuances of these legal concepts and how they play out in real life situations.
Well, that wraps up our deep dive into People v. Kunkin. We hope you found it informative and thought-provoking. Until next time, keep exploring the fascinating world of law.
And stay curious.